Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. It's that time of the week when we put out an episode of the podcast that went out years ago that most of you won't listen to because you weren't in on the action that early on. You weren't early adopters of the History Hit podcast. Well, luckily you're here now and you'll be able to listen to it because it's a classic. This features the geographer Nicholas Crane, who many of you will know as the guy who presented the television series Coast in Britain and went on to make other shows like Map Man and Town as well. But in fact, he's a brilliant writer and has been both before and since those BBC shows. I first came across him when he brilliantly walked from northwest Spain, Santiago de Compostela, along the Pyrenees. He noticed that you could walk from one end of Europe to another virtually along mountain ranges. So he walked along the Pyrenees, skibdaddled over the south of France, got into the Alps. Then from the Alps, you're in the Carpathians and all the rest of it. And he got to Istanbul. Unbelievable. Anyway, he subsequently wrote another even more important and brilliant book about the British landscape. It's a history of the British landscape and how much us humans have messed with it. I love this podcast. It was so interesting talking to him. So I hope you enjoy it. If you want to watch TV shows, don't forget you can go and do so at historyhit.tv. It's our digital history channel where all of these back episodes of the podcast are without any ads. And we've also got a huge number of documentaries, which are growing by two or three every week. Always new material going on there. At the moment, First Britain is the most watched show ever on History Hit TV. Mesolithic. Stone Age. I mean, where are my 18th century fans, folks? Come on, let's do this. And if you really want to listen to wonderful historians in the flesh, come to our live tour. It's historyhit.com/tour. We'll see you all there. In the meantime, everyone, here is the very brilliant Nick Crane.
Hello, everyone. Right, I've got Nicholas Crane here, presenter of many TV shows, bit of a legend here in the UK, and writer of this enormous book. You often have an umbrella in your backpack, not this time. We're going to talk about this big book, but first of all, I'm going to admit to being a little bit of a secret fanboy, Nicholas Crane. When I was travelling, I was on my gap year, I was backpacking, and we didn't have any phones, we didn't have any things that we had to read books, and you'd stop in hostels, and there'd be knackered old books lying around there. And I picked up this book, I'd never heard of you, it was a book about a maniac guy who walks across Europe from the Atlantic, the crashing waters of the Atlantic, all the way to Istanbul, via only using the mountains. It was a brilliant, it was such a simple idea, I can't believe I'd never seen it before. Pyrenees, Alps, Carpathians,
yep, that's right, yeah.
Carpathians, and that big, huge, must be very annoying, huge semicircle, and then down to Istanbul. And I just remember thinking it was the coolest book ever. And then years later, I found out that you were the guy that written it. And of course, I'd seen you on TV shows ever since.
Yeah, no, it was very, I like simple ideas, and that was just a watershed walk. So I was walking from west to east with my left boot effectively in northern temperate Europe, my right boot in warm Mediterranean Europe, right the way across the continent, one side to the other. And I thought lots of other people would go and do the same walk afterwards, but I don't think anyone's ever done it again.
Oh, no, I thought, yeah, I assumed it would become a bit of a thing. It's too hardcore, that's why no one's else done it. But you had to, you did all the unglamorous bits as well, you know, between the Pyrenees and the Alps, you had to like go and sleep in under motorway sort of underpass and stuff like that, didn't you?
Yeah, there were only two sections where I was out of the mountains for a day. One was crossing the Rhone, and the other was crossing the Danube. Yeah, and both you can walk across both those river valleys in a day, and they were interesting in their own right. I mean, you're a man who understands battlefields, but in that gap where the Danube flows between the end of the Alps and the beginning of the Carpathians, you've got Vienna, Bratislava, battlefields, and Roman Carnuntum. I slept in Roman Carnuntum in the barracks there, just to kind of rekindle those Roman connections. And so even the flat areas had stories.
But I didn't even realise it was only 2 days out of the month. That is an amazing thing. You have written so well about sort of geography and historical geography over the years. You're weaving together of the geography and the history, and that book was so impressive. And of course, this is everyone is saying, and I agree, this is the absolute best book to be written on that subject, certainly in terms of the British Isles, the making of the British landscape. The older I get, the more I study history and look at history and think about history, it does seem to me that the geography is absolutely vital. We all toss on about, you know, European empires, and of course it's all about malaria and disease and about rivers and the Congo being unnavigable but the Zambezi being more navigable than Nile. You know, it's actually we are simply little fleas that exist on the rump of this vast planet, and the geography absolutely shapes it.
It's a tricky relationship, isn't it? That sliding scale of geographical determinism. I mean, how far along that scale do you allow yourself to go in deciding that geography shapes history? And it's tricky. And I think you actually have to choose your point on that scale between geography and history according to the story you're trying to tell.
Yeah.
And in this particular one with landscape, it's quite far towards the geographical end. I think because, you know, history is very, very good at events, geography is quite good at processes, and so you just have to choose where on that scale you're going to be. And with evolving landscapes, it's quite far towards the processes end. So there's not a lot of scope for talking about battles in a book about landscape, but there is occasionally scope for talking about monarchs who. Oh, actually, there's only one monarch I can think of, King Alfred, who actually had
an
emphatic effect on landscape. But and the Romans, of course. And so you get historical events that can affect.
Well, let's break it all down into chronology. But briefly, I do feel a bit naughty, you know, admiring people like Jared Diamond and you, and who point out these huge things that are often slightly beyond the human visual spectrum, whether it's microbes, whether it's natural resources that lie under the soil. And I think I was raised in an era where it was still very much the history is talking about great, great men. It was about these geniuses who just bestrode the narrow earth like colossi. And I think the more of these kind of books, the more of this kind of thinking that goes on, I think we'll have a richer and deeper understanding of the past. So thank you.
Well, I'm very flattered by everything you're saying, Dan, because this was a long project.
How long did it take?
It took me 8 years to write, and I've been thinking about it for about 30 years.
You must start as a child,
so,
Nicholas.
Well, there's a man called W.G. Hoskins who published a book in 1955 called The Making of the English Landscape, and all geography undergraduates who are as ancient as I am had to know that book by heart. It was the book that introduced historical geography to students, and this is what you're talking about, the idea that geography can shape history. And it was an overused word, but seminal book. And we had to know it by heart, effectively. And I'd often looked at it and thought, well, maybe I could, you know, revisit it and update it, because 55 is a long time ago. And Hoskins started, it was a book about the English landscape. So he, of course, started with the Anglo-Saxons. And he finishes, of course, in 1955. He doesn't cover Scotland or Wales. So I thought, well, maybe there's a bigger story if I was to bring in Scotland and Wales, and then go back to the end of the Younger Dryas, this Ice Age moment.
Right, so you go back 12,000 years, end of the... Let's take this book on chronologically. I should say we are streaming this podcast on our Facebook page, Dan Snow's History Hit. Hello, everybody on Facebook. If you've got questions, we will answer them at the end. We'll talk about the book first, and then we're going to have some questions for Nicholas. Are you Nick or Nicholas?
Nick.
Let's call him Nick. We're casual, hey? Okay, so 12,000 years ago. Here we go. Let's start. Book one. Right, so Ice Age, even I know we were not an island at that stage. So what happened?
Yeah, so let's go back to about 10,000 BC, and Britain is the frigid glacial extremity of a continuous landmass that reaches the whole way from here to Kamchatka in Eastern Asia and south to Table Mountain in Southern Africa. So, and we're connected to the continent, not across what's now the English Channel, but across what is now the North Sea between East Anglia and Northern Germany. Glaciers in Scotland, 400 metres of ice sitting on top of Rannoch Moor, Great Glen full of ice, glaciers in the Lake District and in Wales. And then an episode of extreme climate change. Temperature bounces up by about 7 degrees centigrade in as little as 50 years.
What?
So it is absolutely mad. That's chaotic.
Crazy.
So all of this ice just falls apart. Scotland.
And were there people living?
No, there's no people in Britain.
No, okay,
at all.
No, okay, good.
So I should go back. So while we have the ice here, it is the temperatures are down to minus 17. It is far too cold for human beings. They've all retreated south of the continent.
Yeah.
So this is the beginning of the story. Britain is uninhabited. There are animals here. We have wolves, reindeer probably coming across the land bridge in summer, a wild horse, lemming, steppe pika. Very, very cold. But when we go through this episode of extreme climate change, temperature bounces up and people move across the land bridge, now known as Doggerland, across what's now the North Sea. And they're following the herds of wild reindeer and wild horse. And there are about 30-odd sites of these early sites that open the story.
And so these people are migrants. They're not settled agricultural people. So actually, for them, the climate change isn't the end of the world. They just follow the herds wherever they're going. They're quite flexible, I
think. That's right. Yeah, so yeah, they're highly flexible. And they're adapting all the time to the changing climate. So they follow the herds. They're hunters, they're foragers. They're wild people, you know. I mean, they are really, they're kind of the prototypical Ray Mears of the world. They're out there doing it for real with flint tools and lighting fires to keep warm at night and hunting. And the reindeer was killed on probably what's now Heathrow Airport and dragged to the edges of the Colne Valley. And that was one of the early sites where Uxbridge is now.
How fantastic. Okay, so then what else? But this climate change, all that ice melts, presumably, so...
Yeah.
Stuff's going to happen.
So cut a long story quite short, 12,000 year story. So the ice melts and people walk across the land bridge and they colonise a peninsula, a European peninsula. This is greening very rapidly indeed. So trees move in fairly briskly. It's not a kind of march of pines northwards. So seeds are being blown on the wind. So you get these little pockets of trees growing up all over the place. And the willow that and dwarf birch and so on are being replaced by more enduring species, the pine, followed by obviously the broad leaves after that. Until we have a time argued, well, it's difficult to say, but maybe 4,000 to 5,000 BC, when we have tree cover across most of Britain, probably about 60% tree cover,
okay.
And maximum 10,000 people.
And how's our landscape changed? Are these big, these river, the glacial valleys and all that kind of stuff that I remember from my geography when I was a kid, the glaciers are retreating, leaving these enormous valleys up, especially in the north of the island?
That's right. So where, for example, you've got Wasdale Screed. So you've got U-shaped glacial valleys, classic U-shape. You take away the ice, the valleys collapse, leaving these huge screed slopes. And then you have the moraines pushed down by the glaciers. When the ice melts, you get these ridges of rubble and sand and so on. So there's a ridge in north between Cromer and Holt. But to this day, it's the only mountain range in Norfolk, and that's an old moraine. There's a huge lake formed behind Scarborough in the Vale of Pickering. There's no lake there now. It's all been drained. But back in the Mesolithic, that was a wonderful kind of hunting, foraging ground, a shallow lake, maybe chest deep. And that was the first known post-glacial landscape. So that was where archaeologists have found stake holes of circular huts and a headdress that's now in the British Museum.
And presumably water was a huge benefit. Obviously, it's fresh water for drinking and fish and things, but also water for trade. It's easier to travel on water than it is on land until very recently in our history. So these are sort of littoral or riverine maritime communities that are springing up, are they?
Yeah. So what Mesolithic communities like are ecotones, these transition zones between the coast and inland, where you've got a broader scope for surviving. So you can forage along the seashore in the intertidal zone, but also you can just stray inland to pick off animals in the woodland and higher up. And the rivers were absolutely critical. And it's fascinating to ask the question, why has Britain been so successful? Because we have, you know, it's a remarkably successful island. And one of the reasons is the rivers, as you pointed out. We have 1,000 river systems, roughly, in this country, and they're all short and fast. We don't, you know, the longest rivers in Britain are only 1/8 the length of the Danube, which means they're all easy to cross. So if you're following herds cross country, and it's very easy to walk 1,000 miles in a year. What did I walk? I walked 6,000 miles in a year and a half. So back then it was completely straightforward to walk from one end to the other of Britain and back again in a year. They wouldn't have thought that was odd. And none of these rivers are too big to cross. And so you were never more probably than 5 or 10 minutes from fresh water, which means survival the chance of survival is rapidly, you know, vastly increased by having access to fresh water.
Britain is nice and wet.
It is very wet.
Okay, so let's go. So this is so exciting. So people are coming back in. There's post holes. So you've got Bronze Age or settlements on crannogs or whatever. But keep going.
Yeah, so the first huge transition. So we have a period from about 9,700 BC right the way through to 4,000 BC, which is roughly half of the story, half of this era, this episode of continuous habitation, when almost nothing happens in terms of human interference with the landscape. We're just hunting and foraging. Probably no more than 10,000 people in the country. So that's about the population of a small market town. But the single biggest landscape event in that era is not human interference. It's actually a tsunami that comes down the North Sea, caused by an undersea slide off Norway that takes out Shetlands, takes out the Orkneys. It's probably that tsunami that takes out Doggerland and cuts us off from the continent. So we have a very hard Brexit situation where we are severed from our Euromates instantly. You know, in probably in minutes or hours, we become islanders.
No way.
And that's the beginning of a story of isolation. We are marooned on this island, 500 million mammals and a few thousand human beings. And the population seems to have dwindled. But around 4050 BC, we have our first Euro shock and the farmers arrive in boats.
Oh, okay.
Everything changes. So that's the beginning of the Neolithic.
Okay, so farmers arrive from Europe. And I suppose, obviously, it goes without saying, but the creation of Britain as an island, a geographical fact, huge impact on subsequent history, on our identity, on our maritime heritage. I mean, you know, it's a foundational fact of British life, isn't it?
That is absolutely huge. One of the frustrating things when you try and investigate the severance of Britain from the continent is actually finding out when it happened. You know, you're basically having to go into geology and radiocarbon dating things to try and find out when that happened.
I think in our lifetime we're going to see some really exciting archaeology from Doggerland, aren't we?
It's all out there. What is out there under the North Sea? One of the most remarkable books I've read in recent years was put together by three archaeologists who realised that the North Sea oil companies had, over the decades, accumulated this vast resource of data about the seabed.
Of course, yeah.
They analysed it and found that the oil companies, while looking for oil, had actually inadvertently mapped all these river systems on the floor of the North Sea. You can actually see the lakes and river systems of Doggerland.
Amazing. Come on, let's keep going. Right, so we've got the Neolithic. We've got these European farmers arriving.
Yeah.
Now, they start to change the landscape.
Yeah, it's devastating. So they bring domesticated animals. So Britain has no domestic animals at this point. Only wild
pigs,
animals.
Pigs, cows, sheep.
They bring seeds, emmer wheat. They start cultivating plots. They start tending their animals.
This is 4,000.
This is about 4,000 BC.
4,000 BC. Okay.
4,000 BC, yeah.
Right. So just as the Egyptians are starting to really gear up things over there.
Exactly.
We are getting the first signs of agrarian culture.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're well behind the curve. So we are right out on the edge of the European landmass at a time when on the Euphrates they're busy living in villages and they're sedentary, they're living in communities and farming. So we're well behind the curve. And farming, meanwhile, has crept across Europe, you know, year by year and has reached the English Channel, the French side of the Channel. And so we are, if you like, along with Scandinavia, the last undeveloped preserve wilderness in Europe. And then when it arrives, it's devastating because they almost certainly brought disease because our hunter, forager, forebears weren't used to living with animals. And the transition happened very rapidly. In terms of the landscape, the farmers brought traditions of, for example, building a permanent monuments above ground. So we get the long barrows, we get portal dolmens, we get henges, causewayed enclosures. They were wonderful archaeologists called Richard Bradley, spoke of them as being altars of the earth. You know, the Neolithic farmers believed in shaping the landscape, altering the earth to their own ends, whereas their Mesolithic predecessors tended to, they're very soft footprint, you know, it's going to leave nothing but your footprints, very gentle.
And presumably lots of cutting down trees.
Lots cutting down trees, yeah. And so the wildwoods in Ritchie, in fact, the wildwood had already been affected during the Mesolithic, but once the farmers arrive, it becomes a contest. It's the first of two massive contests in Britain, the contest between cultivation and farming and the wildwood. The wildwood gets pushed back and back and back and back, and then by the time you get through to about 1500 BC, you get the first surviving field systems.
You're listening to Dan Snow's History. This is one of the old podcasts, but it's one of the best, with Nicholas Crane talking about history of the British landscape. More coming up after this.
Did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the History of Sex Scandal in Society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Is there a single acre of, let's start with Britain, which is left from our ancient past? Can I go and just commune with the Mesolithic world?
No, there's not. I'm afraid, Dan, there's not a single acre left, because it's all been modified.
Okay.
That's not to say that there isn't a lot of beauty, of course.
Hey, listen, but I'm a big fan, but okay, that's interesting. Okay, so these farmers chop down trees, starting to build fields and grazing and sheep and everything like that. Okay, we'd notice, started to set up towns and things? Or
no,
villages?
That's a lot later.
No. Okay, right.
Towns and villages a lot later. So we have small... We have small communities of farmers who are probably still hunting and foraging as well. So it's not as if they came in and imposed permanent settlements immediately. That was a long process of evolution. So we've got a transition time when people are they're growing their crops, they're tending their domesticated animals, but they're also still hunting and foraging, because Britain is like a gigantic game park.
Mm.
You know, you can live very well out in the woods and glades and along the seashores. So it takes a long time, and it's not until about 1500 BC that you see the first rectangular field systems preserved on the British landscape there on Dartmoor, but there were probably thousands of square miles of them by then.
Okay, and population starts to go up, and this is controversial, isn't it, this whole idea of do we actually create more calories and more population when we start to farm? I didn't realise what an exciting issue this was in the world of geohistory.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I dare stray there.
Okay,
right,
well,
now,
but briefly, the population goes up, does it?
Population goes up, and then why the population goes up is, does the population go up because people have found food security by living in permanent settlements?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they pushing out and out and out, and the pioneering farmers also foraging and hunting and bringing in so much food that they're able to feed their rising communities, and then subsequently gather together in these nodes. So it's a question of it's difficult to unpick, okay. But there are these permanent settlements appearing. By the time you get to 1000 BC, we're dotted in year-round settlements.
And do we see exploitation of mineral wealth and empires developing and weapons and kings getting gold and copper and then becoming rich and then beating up other people? And when do we start to see that sort of activity?
Well, you can see a very early sign of it was in the probably the first or second generation of farmers who arrived, because the first big modifications to landscape are not actually long barrows or fields, they're flint mines in the South Downs. So there are about 400 different flint mines along the tops of the South Downs behind Worthing and Brighton. And they didn't have to dig for this flint. They would dig it, you could pick it up off the surface. Geologically, the flint on the surface was identical to the flint in the subterranean seams, but they believed there was value in excavating from these mines. So even at this very early stage, we're having prized stone that was being probably traded or certainly exchanged long distance. So we have stone from the Lake District making its way down to the Thames Valley, and stone from Rum crossing to other Scottish islands and so on. So stone's being traded. There's a really big transition in the Iron Age when we have when people have migrated for reasons not entirely clear to hilltops. You get the first hilltop enclosures, probably stock enclosures, which then mutate into hill forts. And then, as you say, we you know, elites are apparent on the landscape. And Barry Cunliffe, the archaeologist, has actually plotted the location of hill forts in Wessex and would argue that there were power centres distributed to control blocks of land.
They certainly feel like it when you clamber over them. Mm. It's wonderful. Okay, so we this is ridiculous. We have got this long journey to go, and we have hardly even started yet, and this podcast is nearly up. Okay, so we got these Iron Age hill forts now. Let's talk about what is the next massive change for landscape? Is it the Romans? Those pesky Romans?
I'd like to just not quite reach Rome, but I know we've got to rush on.
Okay.
But there was, because this is a kind of developmental tragedy in Britain's story. There came a point in the first century BC when we came down from the hill forts and settled in demarcated low-lying centres that have been given the name Oppida, and there were about a dozen of them in southern Britain, and they were proto-towns, so they had their own mints, they were trading with Europe, they were probably power centres of some kind, and they were centres of population. So it has been argued these were proto-towns, and so we're just at this point, 10,000 years into our story, 10,000 years, we have just got to the point when you could argue we're dipping our toes in the waters of civilization, we're in contact with the continent. And at that moment, we get invaded by this army of psychopathic builders who wreck the place and set us back 800 years.
Wow, so explain, why so?
Well, I understand the romance of Roman fortresses and hot baths and so on, but the fact is that when the Romans came, they imposed their own idea of civilization on a landscape that was peripheral to the empire, right on the very edge of it, and it wasn't resilient. So, if you just look at towns, for example, we already had the beginnings of towns just before they arrived. They built around or established about 100 towns in Britain during their stay, along with long walls and forts and fortresses and all the rest of it. After the collapse of the Roman Empire, all of the towns disappeared. We had no towns left at all. They simply didn't introduce urbanisation in a resilient form.
I see what you mean.
So it was the Romans went. We then went back to effectively, in developmental terms, to the Iron Age. I mean, we call it the Anglo-Saxon era. The Saxons, the Jutes and Angles came across here, but the buildings they were constructing were very like the Iron Age buildings. They were timber framed, reed thatch. They weren't enduring. They didn't build in masonry. You know, the Romans had brought all these amazing masonry structures, and they were building for eternity.
But they'd also sort of decapitated any indigenous building tradition. Okay, well, you're speaking, of course, I'm really thinking about my trips to the Congo and place post-colonial societies in Africa and elsewhere where, yes, Europeans come in and do loads of building and amazing things and then just disappear and actually having completely ruined the society which they'd arrived supposedly to revolutionise and civilise.
That's exactly it, Dan, absolutely. Just no resilience. And it takes a very long time. You have to go forward to about 880 AD with King Alfred on the throne, and he's the kind of the only big historical figure I really talk about in the book. And he reintroduces urbanisation on a resilient basis. So we have him establishing Britain, Wessex. His land is under threat from the more than under threat. It's under siege from the Vikings, and he establishes these burhs, these walled urban settlements that have two main functions. They're defensive structures for his population, his people, but they also have a market function as well. So they've got this economic function, and this, of course, is the beginning of permanent urbanization.
Sustainable,
sustainable urbanization.
Okay.
Alfred.
So let's talk about Britain in the period of Alfred, and obviously in Wales and Scotland, lots of diverse and dynamic kingdoms rising and falling, as in other parts of England at the time. Let's do an invoice, an inventory check. Animals, native species, how are they? They've been hammered, or are they doing all right?
Yeah, they've been hammered. So the aurochs, for example, which was the this magnificent, you can't really call it a wild cow because it was much more magnificent. It's an enormous wild bovine monster that used to roam the Mesolithic forests of Britain with huge horns, fantastic for hunting, you know, huge amount of meat on an aurochs. That was driven into extinction by the Bronze Age. Wolves are still prowling, and by the time we in the Age of Alfred, we still have wolves and bears. There's a really interesting moment in if we skip forward to the 16th century, where there's a wonderful map maker called Timothy Pont, Scottish map maker, who has rather been overlooked by the history books because he only left sketch maps, but he drew a sketch map of Cape Wrath, which is a northwestern point on the British mainland, at a time when at the other end of Britain, London was the biggest city in Britain, a population of 75,000. Timothy Pont drew this map of northwest Scotland with, and he labelled it extreme wilderness. And this was the kind of the moment the wilderness really vanished from the British landscape.
Just before the Industrial Revolution, then.
Yeah, before the Industrial Revolution. And in fact, there was an interim episode of interference, landscape interference, in the 1620s, when if you turn back and think of the post-glacial landscape as having two wild elements, the forests, the wildwood, and wetlands. The forests had been not entirely wiped out, but driven, massively reduced by the 16th century. So, you know, as you know, I mean, we're running out of shipbuilding timbers and so on. The wetland was still pretty much intact. And all the way down eastern England, there's this long chain of wetland from the Humber right the way down to Cambridgeshire. So these huge glittering fens separated by, you know, the Isle of Ely, Isle of Axholme and so on. But in 1621, Vermuyden, Dutch engineer, comes over, starts draining our wetlands. And that's the end of the wilderness properly. So we've got the wetlands being converted into unbelievably rich agricultural land. And that's a big, big moment. So that predates the Industrial Revolution, but it's laying the basis for interfering with nature on a massive scale. And running out of the back of the draining of the wetlands, we have the subversion of these wonderful natural river systems, 1,000 of them, by building canals.
Yeah, we've canalised and sewerised our rivers in this country, haven't we?
Exactly.
We've got no, it's impossible to talk about ancient rivers because people don't understand what they were. Yeah. They'd be highways, I agree. So let's talk about that sort of spasm of early modern changing our landscape. We do the fens, and then talk to me about enclosures, because this is obviously a big historical thing. This sort of enclosures and private property, and the emergence, particularly in England and the lowlands of Scotland, of this sort of patchwork field system we now think is this ancient and immortal British landscape, which actually is quite recent.
Yeah, so the enclosures was a very long, drawn-out process. There was a... the medieval field system was one of open fields where you had, and you can still you can still see them out of train windows across central Britain. But the ridge and furrow, if you look out of a train window in a low light in winter, and you'll see these ridges and furrows in fields. So those were the
like open corrugated iron.
Exactly. Yeah. So these were the open field systems, and they were huge. So in any one village, each villager or each family would have their own strip. They would cultivate it on their own, and these banks of earth would pile up deliberately because it allowed the runoff, the water, to run into the furrows and drain to the edge of the field. However, it was pointed out much later on during the Agricultural Revolution, this was a ridiculous way to farm because all the nutrients were washed out of the field in these furrows. So although we're sentimental about ridge and furrow now, once you had field drainage pipes put underneath the fields, you could then plough all of these ridges and furrows out, and then the fields were systematized through enclosure, either by landowners driving the villagers off their land, taking hold of their entire holding, and then rationalizing these huge open fields into small rectangular blocks. So we're sentimental about these rectangular fields now, but actually they're moderately recent imposed structures. And then we had parliamentary enclosures, which kind of followed in after that and spelled the end to open field farming. But so we went from the medieval open system of ridge and furrow to much smaller rectangular blocks. And now we're in a later generation of industrial farming where you've got the smaller fields have been enlarged into larger fields, and we have, you know, contract farmers playing all night and all that kind of thing.
With GPS tractors self-driving
exactly
around.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay. So, but what's interesting, at the same time to get that huge rationalisation in the countryside, we also see the world's first industrial revolution. And that must be an enormous impact on Britain's landscape.
It's huge. And there's a fascinating debate about, you know, why did Britain lead the world into industrial revolution? And you know, you've talked earlier on about geography steering history sometimes. And I was often wondering while I was writing this, what effect did this extraordinary river network we have on Britain have on the Industrial Revolution? Because when you think about it, you know, the Industrial Revolution, we couldn't have happened without coal and without iron and without water. Now, the thing about the Industrial Revolution is that as much as anything, it was a revolution in ideas. So lots of individuals, not necessarily even educated, but coming up with brilliant ideas. It might be cotton spinning or whatever. And nearly everybody had access to fast moving water in Britain. So almost everyone could have a lab in their back garden. The nature of the Industrial Revolution was that Britain's population rocketed at unbelievable speed. So by around 1850, we've got 21 million people living in Britain. And we cross a critical threshold when, by around the mid-19th century, we reached that tipping point when more of us are living in towns and cities than in the countryside. And now, 90% of us are living in towns and cities and 10 in the countryside. So we crossed that tipping point in the 1850s. And the population was growing so fast that housing had to be reactive. You know, there was this idea about, you know, Thomas More utopia in the early 1500s. And he did this wonderful image of urban settlements surrounded by green space that was picked up by the New Town movement, Ebenezer Howard and so on. The reality was, in the Industrial Revolution, all we could do was to react to a population that was effectively out of control by building vast numbers, I mean, thousands and thousands of small back-to-back houses, industrial housing, which very quickly became slums. So if you read, you know, Engels on Manchester and Dickens, you know, that Britain, with all of these industrial centres, were dominated by these, by machine housing, mass-produced housing. There was nothing utopian about it at all. It was purely a desperate measure to house the workers to keep this population going. And of course, now, today, we're having to live with the aftereffects of that, because we now have vast amounts of housing stock in places that can't provide employment, because in the modern world, we've moved to a service economy and industries in other parts of the country.
And traditionally, I suppose, you'd have shut down Stoke-on-Trent and moved over to Cambridge. Well, so, of course, that's not an option anymore.
No, it's not an option. And so we have what is a real housing crisis. You know, the announcement this week to build 100,000 prefabs, really historic moment, really historic. You know, going back to the post-war moment when Beaverbrook and the announcement to build 300,000 houses urgently after the Second World War to rehouse people who had lost their houses through bombing and so on. You know, we have reached that stage again where we have a housing crisis, a real genuine housing crisis. A whole generation who have nowhere to live, who won't have anywhere to live. They can't afford to get their foot on the ladder. So and people need to live where there's work. Otherwise, we create massive transport issues, shifting as people are migrating every day to their place of work.
Well, that was a sort of totally crazy rampage through the whole of British history. I think we should do a whole series of podcasts on this subject. It's so fascinating. But I guess lastly, when you wrote this mighty book and you spent all these years thinking about it and touring and walking around the whole United Kingdom and beyond, what are the sort of big thoughts that come out of this? What do you think our geography, both physical and human, is telling us about the state of the country today and also perhaps where we're heading?
Oh, Dan, that's a bit cosmic.
Right,
you caught me out. Okay, that's really tricky. I mean, I think if you look back through time, the really huge systemic changes have been to do with the Earth's natural systems. So the beginning of this story, 12,000 years ago, begins with an episode of climate change, 7 degrees centigrade, 50 years, unbelievable. You know, we're talking now about preparing ourselves maybe 1.5, 2 degrees over the next 100 years.
Yes,
that's pretty extreme in itself, actually. You know, a 1 degree change, as we know from the past, I mean, you know about the Little Ice Age and when the Thames froze over in the 1600s, that was probably a drop of about 1 degree. We're very exposed in Britain to, for example, the Gulf Stream turning on and off.
No, don't. It's terrifying.
So it was probably the Gulf Stream turning back on in 9700 BC that opened this thermal window that we're in now. And if the Gulf Stream turns off, then we go back to a southern Alaskan climate, which is roughly where we're level with latitudinally. So that's not said. So it is critically important that we address greenhouse gases. And there's no question that that is, in terms of preserving our island habitat for future generations, that is number one priority.
And when you were writing this book, did you, this coming back almost this central point of Britain being an island and the development of culture and ideas and our relationship with Europe, are you more likely now to think that geography is destiny at the end of this book?
I'm lucky enough to be the president of the Royal Geographical Society at the moment, and there isn't a role that for me is more important to be doing at the moment. It is something that it's a belief system for me, geography. I believe that a subject that informs you about people, places, the environment, is a basic foundation course for life. It certainly has given me everything I've ever done. All the work I've ever done in my life, and the whole way I look at the world, it comes from geography. I think it's a foundation course for life, and it's something that will equip future generations to deal with some really massive issues. Nearly every massive issue we read about in the news feeds today, whether it's migration, whether it's climate change, sea level rise, urbanisation, they're all geographical stories, and we need more geographical experts. You know, this has to be the age of the expert.
I'm sure you'll share my frustration that for some insanely bizarre reason in the UK, you're forced to choose between history and geography when you're 14 yeah. years old, yeah. and then you're allowed to give up both of them at 16.
Yeah.
And they were my two best subjects. I completely shafted my own education by having to give up one of my... And I could never understand. They were always two sides of a coin.
Mm,
and
agony, yeah.
So bring about that positive change in your illustrious position.
Absolute agony, yeah.
Nicholas, thank you very much. Nicholas Craden's book... The Making of the British Landscape is out and it's brilliant. And what are you on Twitter and Facebook or anything? How do people follow you and get in touch with you over your website?
I'm a rather slack Twitterer.
Okay.
I ought to improve. Well, do better.
Okay, yeah. What are you on Twitter?
All right, I haven't got a clue, I'm afraid.
Okay, never mind. Look for Nicholas Craden on Twitter. He's awesome. I'll tweet it out. Now, listen, we've been ignoring Facebook Live. Just quickly before we go, because we got to leave and let you get on with your life. How does your work relate to Oliver Rackman's History of the Countryside?
Oliver Rackman.
Yes, yeah. Okay, this is a good point. So we talked about Rackman and Hoskins. What are the big things that you've updated?
I'd hesitate to say I've updated anyone. I'm a storyteller, and this is a story about the British landscape. I'm not an academic. I wanted to write a clean linear narrative, a geographical narrative from the end of the Ice Age to the present, this episode of continuous habitation. So the writer who inspired me most was Hoskins, who wrote this book, The Making of the English Landscape. Oliver Rackham wrote wonderful books about the countryside, and of course, and I've pilfered material from his books, particularly to do with wildwood. But I've used thousands of sources. I didn't put them in the book, but there are, I've forgotten how many footnotes there were, but thousands of footnotes scaffolding to allow me to make this book. And I used archaeology huge amounts. So this could not have been written without Britain's brilliant archaeologists. This is, if anything, a book written with the help of archaeologists.
You've mentioned a few of them today, like the legendary Barry Cunliffe.
Absolutely, Barry Cunliffe and Richard Bradley, a huge figure in the Mesolithic. I was very, very inspired by his work as well.
Well, listen, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to everyone who's watching. Sorry we've had some connection problems. We've got the Wi-Fi issues here, obviously. Nicholas, thank you very much.
Dan, great pleasure meeting you.
See you next time. Bye-bye.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders. All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished.
Hi, just a quick message at the end of this podcast. If you could go to wherever you get your podcasts, if you could give it a 5-star rating, if you could share it, if you could give it a review, I really appreciate that. Then from the comfort of your own homes, you'll be doing me a massive favor. Then more people will listen to the podcast. We can do more and more ambitious things, and I can spend more of my time getting pummeled. Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us, and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.